507-7113. McKenzie Corporation et al. Versus the Commonwealth Republic of Iran, Pellet Financial Organization for the Financial Ownership of Productive Team et al. Mr. Byers for the Indian Period. Mr. Corcoran for the Appellate. Mr. Brady for the Appellate.
May it please the Court, I'm Thomas Byron from the Department of Justice, here on behalf of the United States as amicus. The government is participating in this case to address only a single question. That question is whether the Treaty of Amity between the United States and Iran should itself be read to provide a private right of action under United States law to determine whether Iran must pay compensation. Here, there's no doubt that the Treaty of Amity's provisions that are at issue here are self-executing. But as I think everyone now agrees, that by itself does not answer the question whether the treaty provides a private right of action. The Supreme Court in Amrata Hess, although in dicta, acknowledged the distinction between a substantive rule of decision provided by a treaty, self-executing, and a private right of action, which in that case, in similar provisions, the Supreme Court said the treaty did not provide. The executive appears in court today on this question because it is one of unique importance and significance to the conduct of foreign relations by the executive of the United States. And because of that, the courts of the United States traditionally and properly give deference to the views of the states and state and justice departments concerning the meaning of treaties.
Of course, the government's view has changed on this question, hasn't it?
The view of the Department of State and the Department of Justice, Judge Tatel, has not changed.
Your view is just different from OPIC's.
Our view is different than private counsel for OPIC operating under that agency's independent litigating authority, Judge Tatel. That's correct. An agency with independent litigating authority occasionally takes positions in lower courts that the Solicitor General or the Department of Justice subsequently determines will not be supported by the United States as a whole. And that's essentially what happened here.
Has the Justice Department ever taken a different view than it's taking now? Not in this litigation, but elsewhere.
With respect to the Treaty of Amity, I believe not, Judge Griffith. I'm not aware of any position that the United States has taken with respect to similar treaties, FCN treaties, concerning whether they create a right of action. And that's really the relevant question under United States law.
You were about to explain, before I interrupted you, why the government's position is critical to U.S. foreign policy. Why don't you go ahead with that?
Thank you, Judge Tatel. The concern here is one of reciprocity, principally, that our treaty partners in these FCN treaties with similar provisions, which we have bilaterally with many other governments, will look to decisions of the United States courts in determining what the position of the United States is with respect to the proper interpretation of these treaties. It would complicate and be to the detriment of United States foreign policy if those treaty partners concluded that the United States believes that the Treaty of Amity provisions create a private right of action for suit in the domestic courts of the treaty partners. Rather, we believe, and I believe this is borne out by the practice of the United States and its treaty partners, that the Treaty of Amity represents a promise between the two partner governments, the treaty partners, each promising the other to provide certain rights to the nationals of the other government. That has been executed in the United States with respect to this just compensation provision of the Treaty of Amity by the takings remedy available in the Court of Federal Claims under the Tucker Act. Now, it's up to our treaty partners to implement the reciprocal obligation in their own legal systems according to the proper approach that they deem appropriate. But because of the presumption of that a treaty will not be read to create a private right of action, as the in-bank First Circuit said in Lee,
I just wonder why you don't seem to take any comfort from the Supreme Court's recent decision in Medellin.
We certainly
rather than citing the First Circuit's opinion.
We certainly do, Judge Garland. Of course, the Medellin decision came out after our brief in this case.
I know, but we're here.
Absolutely, Judge Garland, and it certainly does support the distinction between.
Doesn't it expressly say exactly that distinction?
It expressly says, Judge Garland, you're correct, although perhaps in dicta, that.
Well, I think it clearly is in dicta, but
that a self-executing treaty does not necessarily create a private right of action. Absolutely. But we think that's well settled, and there's really no dispute here.
Can I ask you, Iran argues that if there is a cause of action here, it's for foreign nationals in the other's court. So that would mean Iran has to provide one, but leaving that aside, the question that would be relevant to you is whether we have to provide one if, for example, we expropriated Iranian property.
Judge Garland, our position on that is that the Tucker Act remedy in the Court of Federal Claims is the proper means for.
I know, but I'm just asking that rationale.
Yes.
That the treaty itself provides the cause of action in that context. Do you agree or disagree with that?
As a matter of United States law, we disagree, although there will never be occasion to answer that question because of the Tucker Act. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of Iranian law, of course, we have no position. Iran might take the position that under its own legal system, the treaty has that effect. Judge Tatel, I see my time's expired.
Yeah, that's okay.
But if the court has further questions.
Yeah, I do. Do you have anything more to say about the state, about the government's view on the customary international law question?
We think it is actually, if anything, much harder for plaintiffs to establish a cause of action under customary international law, even than it would be under a treaty. After all, a treaty, if self-executing, is law of the United States. Now, that doesn't answer the harder question whether it creates a private right of action, but customary international law by itself is not necessarily law of the United States. And the Supreme Court in Sosa emphasized that it would be the rare circumstance, and only where, under the Alien Tort Statute at issue in that case, Congress had provided a basis for concluding that customary international law might be a source for legal rules. Otherwise, there's no basis for doing so.
Do I recall that in your brief you suggested that were we to agree with you on the Treaty of Amity, we should leave it up to the district court to address the customary international law and the Iranian law questions?
We certainly think that the question whether Iranian law provides a right of action is properly addressed by district court. I think it would be appropriate for this court, if the court wishes to do so, to point out the very challenging problems that customary international law would pose.
We do have a decision from the district court. It's properly before us, correct?
I'm not sure that's
briefed.
Correct. It certainly has been briefed, and it would be up to this court, of course, to address it. We don't think there's any reason that this court would be precluded from doing so.
But you don't think we should?
We haven't taken a position on that, Judge Tatel.
No, I know you haven't taken a position on the issue, but you haven't taken a position on whether we should address it.
That's correct, Judge Tatel. Our role today is quite limited, only addressing expressly.
Well, do you have any thoughts for us about didn't tell us your position on the customary international law either, but you told us sort of what you think. Do you have any views about what you sort of think about whether we should address the customary international law issue? Help us with this. Are there reasons to ask the district court to address it again, does it make sense to ask the district court to look at the Iranian law question first? Might that resolve this?
Judge Tatel, I think that would be a very reasonable way of approaching the problem. I'd also submit that we'd be happy to provide an additional briefing to the court that would reflect the Solicitor General's views. I've not been authorized to go further on that question at this point,
and
however.
Would the same deference be due the government on the customary international law question as Medellin says is due on the treaty question?
Yes, absolutely, Judge Tatel, and we'd be happy to provide citations to that for that point as well.
Okay.
As long as we're on additional subjects, has the government taken a position on the active state doctrine as it applies to the customary international law cause of action?
Not in this case, Judge Garland, and I've not been authorized to address that question.
But the government might take a position since least with respect to the Hickenlooper Amendment, it's quite relevant whether or not the government, what the government's position is.
I think that's a fair point, Judge Garland. If the court would like to hear the government's views, we'd consider submitting additional briefing on that at the court's request.
And I thought it was the government's position that we actually not reach the customary international law.
We think it would be...
In footnote 2 of your brief, you suggest that we shouldn't do that.
We think that there's no reason to reach it because of the availability.
You say you should not reach those questions. That's more normative.
Thank you, Judge Griffith. That's a better reading than I'd given of my own brief.
Text.
Exactly. We think because the plaintiffs here have pointed to Iranian law as an alternative source, that alternative source should be explored fully before the courts get into these much more difficult questions of treaty-based or customary international law-based rights of action.
Well, you're not suggesting we defer the treaty-based argument, right?
No, that question has been fully briefed, and we think that the district court was plainly wrong on that, Judge Tatel.
I was just responding to the way you answered, Judge Griffith.
But both questions present similar problems. In fact, as we pointed out, the customary international law question presents even greater problems. And for that reason, we think that the courts should have looked to Iranian law as a source before turning to these more problematic
Do you think the district
approaches.
Court abused its discretion in denying the motion to reconsider the customary international law issue?
Again, Judge Griffith, I've not been authorized to take a position on that question. I will say, though, that in the district court, we were prepared to address that question as amicus curiae, and the district court cut off the planned briefing, I believe, in that on that question. If the court has no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. On the customary international law question, Iran moved for reconsideration on that issue in June or July of 2003. McKesson asked for extension of time after extension of time and never addressed the issue on the merits. This issue has now been addressed by Iran again and again and again for over...
But we have a ruling from the district court on the customary international law issue, right? And the district court held that there was a cause of action. And now, if I remember correctly, I may not, it's before us on denial of a motion for reconsideration.
That's
abuse of discretion standard, right?
Yes, it is an abuse of discretion standard. I'd say it's an abuse of discretion. McKesson wasn't even required to oppose it. Mm-hmm. They asked for extension of time after extension of time after extension of time, and then just as the government was about to file a brief giving its opinion, the district court denied the motion without comment.
Did the district court know that the government was offering a brief on the subject?
When the government
described this as cutting off, is that a fair
description? I think that I'm not sure he knew. I can't remember enough.
Okay. On that question, were we to decide against you on the treaty cause of action, would that change the relationship between the customary international law cause of action and the active state doctrine? You would no longer have this treaty argument that you have had before with respect to active state.
If you've got the treaty, you don't need customary international law.
I'm asking you to assume. I know it's always hard for a lawyer to assume they're going to lose one point, but I ask you to assume just for the purposes of this argument that you lost the treaty cause of action. Would that change the relationship between active state and the, at least change the arguments that have to be made between active state and the customary international law cause of action?
Well, conceivably, but it just seems to me you never reach the CIL issue if you've got the Treaty of Amity issue. I'm not getting the question.
The question is, assume we were to decide there is no treaty cause of action.
Oh.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Against your position, I'm not saying we are going to, I'm just asking you to assume that, so I can see whether the cause of action are dependent or independent. Assume you were to lose that, then does that change the arguments that have to be made with respect to the customary international law claim?
Iran's position is that there's no cause of action under the Treaty of Amity. So you're, if Iran loses, that means you're
I'm not counter to your argument. I'm sorry. Now I'm confused. Counter to the your opponent's argument.
All right. Let's assume that Iran wins. On
yes,
the, on,
yes,
so there is
yes,
no
sorry.
Treaty
yeah,
cause
yeah,
of
yeah,
action
yeah.
argument.
Yes,
well,
I'm
yes,
sorry.
Sure. It changes.
I'm the one who's confusing you. Right.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it changes the argument.
In what way does it change the...
Because there's no standard of compensation.
Well, the standard of compensation is different from whether there's an independent cause of action, right? The treaty can create a standard with, and I thought that was part of the argument, it can create substantive standards without necessarily creating rights.
Yes.
All right, so assume it does create the substantive standard, but doesn't create an independent cause of action.
I don't think that, I think that any substantive standards created by the treaty are subject to the procedural requirements of the treaty. So you can't say that there's a standard in the treaty and then apply it in the customary international law case. Any, the rights granted under the treaty are subject to the remedy the treaty provides. So I don't think the treaty, if you decide there's no cause of action under the treaty doesn't help McKesson's argument or customary international law.
Does it change the nature of their argument? They won on customary international law below, right? Was that in any way dependent on there being an independent cause of action under the treaty?
Sure. Judge Flannery ruled that he didn't have to worry about the standard of compensation because he had the Treaty of Amity. We think that that was error. The treaty's provision of standards is subject to the procedural rights of Iran under the treaty. Moving on, Your Honor, it's clear that the treaty provides a cause of action in the Iranian court in this case. It gives McKesson, in this case, freedom of access to Iran's courts, quote, in all degrees of jurisdiction, that gives it jurisdiction, both in defense and pursuit of its rights. In pursuit of its rights is a cause of action. The last clause of Article 4.1 about effective means of enforcement of lawful contractual rights is to the same effect. Thus, the treaty clearly provides a cause of action in Iran's court in a case like this. The question is the treaty remedy, was it intended by the treaty parties to be exclusive? McKesson argues that to expressly conflict the term used in Amirata Hess, there must be forum exclusivity language. First of all, the treaty has forum exclusivity language. It requires that any dispute as to the application or interpretation of the treaty not satisfactorily adjusted by diplomacy shall be submitted to the International Court of Justice. The House report, the term express comes from the House report on the FSIA. In the sentence right after that sentence with the word express, the House report gives two examples of treaties that the FSIA would not, quote, alter. They are NATO-SOFA treaties and treaties such as this one. The Ninth Circuit in Moore concluded that the first example, the NATO-SOFA treaty, expressly conflicts. What we're asking you to do is to rule that FCN treaties, such as the Treaty of Amity, the second example, also expressly conflicts. And it expressly conflicts for the same reason. It's to be noted here that the exclusivity language in Moore is not as exclusive as the exclusive language here. The exclusivity language in Moore just says how claims will be handled in the receiving state. They don't talk about the sending state. In this case, all claims, all disputes have to be decided for final decision by the ICJ. None of the other three cases on which we rely, Amirata Hess, McKesson 1, or Third Avenue, were decided based on the presence or absence of forum exclusivity language. So the issue is not forum exclusivity language. It's whether, as a practical matter, the treaty remedy conflicts with the FSIA remedy. That's obviously true. Suppose you uphold the judgment against Iran. Iran can go to the ICJ. McKesson agrees that Iran can go to the ICJ. The ICJ has held in the hostages case at the instance of the United States, that its jurisdiction in these cases is compulsory. The ICJ will certainly take jurisdiction, and I think will likely reverse the court. So you'll have a position in which, if McKesson collects on its $40 million judgment, it'll have $40 million. The United States will have to pay Iran $40 million. And because we agree, the United States has agreed that the ICJ has a final must make a final decision in this case, McKesson will have gotten $40 million that is contrary to the treaty. We don't think that that's what the treaty negotiating parties meant back in 1957 when they were negotiating the treaty. The fact that there's no forum exclusivity language in the treaty is not remarkable. It was quite clear back in 1957 that a plaintiff such as McKesson could not have sued Iran or any other foreign government for an expropriation in the courts of the United States on any theory, because the Act of State Doctrine would have intercepted would have defeated the claim. I know of no case before 1957, and Professor Ramsey, who was our expert in this case, knows of no case in which that happened. So there was no reason to put in forum exclusivity language. The interpretation of the treaty parties also supports this view. First of all, this is Iran's interpretation of the treaty, and it's entitled to certain deference. Second, although the United States is diffident before you today, previously, particularly in the House report, it made clear that the treaty was viewed as the exclusive remedy. This was a treaty that the terms of the FSIA, and it, as the House report puts it, would not alter. There isn't jurisdiction under the FSIA anyway. The district court found that up until 1979, McKesson was paid in accordance with the law for the attraction and protection of foreign investment. He then found the Iranian government took over control of PAX Board in 1980. He then found that the failure to pay McKesson in 1980, then thereafter, was the result of an Iranian government decision to prevent capital flight out of the country. Such a decision is sovereign conduct. PAC-DERI's decision to obey the law is sovereign conduct. Two conclusions flow from these findings. The first is, following Weltover, there's no jurisdiction. Control of foreign currency exchange is sovereign conduct. Assuming at any point it wasn't sovereign conduct, there's no direct effect in the United States because under the law for attraction and protection
I'm not sure I'm following the first argument. Anything that's sovereign conduct, there's no jurisdiction for?
If you're depending on the commercial activity exception, you can't rely on sovereign conduct.
Well, if you can't rely on sovereign conduct at all, then the FSIA wouldn't apply at all because it only applies to a sovereign. So the question is, what is the meaning of for an act outside the territory of the United States in connection with a commercial activity? So as long as the act can be sovereign as long as it's in connection with the commercial activity, and that's what we held before in this case.
All right, well, it's not in connection with a commercial activity. Obeying the law is not a commercial activity.
Does that mean you're giving up the first argument? Well, let me put it that way. When you say all right, I mean, all right, that's correct, and we should move on to the next argument? You agree that the fact that it's sovereign conduct doesn't take us out of A3 because it doesn't say a commercial act. It says an act in connection with commercial activity.
What I'm saying is it's not an act in connection with a commercial activity. It's just following the law.
Well, the dairy is a commercial activity.
Not when it's following the law.
Really? You mean all American companies that follow the law are not engaged in commercial activity?
This is
not going to make an awful lot of people nervous.
Your Honor, this is not an argument made by the other side, so I'm not that.
It is an argument made by the other side. It's exactly the argument. It's the argument we've already decided, that you can have a sovereign act, and as long as it's in connection with commercial activity, it comes within the commercial activity exception.
It seems my argument would have to be that it's not in connection with a commercial activity. That's the best I can do, Your Honor.
Okay.
All right. Let's assume then that it's not sovereign activity. It doesn't have a direct effect on the United States. Let's look what Mr. Fisher did. Mr. Fisher, after he got his dividends from Pack Dairy and put them in.
Is this different than the argument we've already considered and upheld before? Is there anything new about what happened in the district court this time that changes the calculus? Because the argument you're making now sounds very much like the argument that was considered and rejected by the Court of Appeals before.
I don't think that the effect of the law for the attraction and protection was made before. If you look at if you look at the addendum, page 13, paragraph 13, quite clearly, after getting the dividend in the bank account from Pack Dairy, the American investor has to make an application to the Iranian government.
That's a different. This is on your sovereign, not sovereign question. I'm talking about the effect on the United States argument that you're making now.
That's what I'm addressing.
What physical change with respect to the effect on the United States was presented in the district court this time that wasn't presented before?
The law for the attraction his finding that the law for the attraction and protection of foreign investment was how payment was made in this case. I don't think that was addressed before.
Right, but the arguments, my recollection is that the arguments that were considered by the court before and which were accepted by the court before was that the consequence of these acts, sovereign or not sovereign, but the consequence of the acts changed money that was being passed to the United States, money that wasn't being passed to the United States, equipment that was being passed to the United States, equipment that wasn't being passed, all the relationship between the home office of the company and the Iran office all changed.
All right, it's the cutoff of contacts.
Yeah.
All right, the cutoff of contacts, his findings changed the other evidence at trial changed the factual picture as to the cutoff of contacts. First of all, it appeared from the evidence at trial that it was McKesson that cut off the contacts, not Pack Dairy. Secondly, to the extent that Pack Dairy cut off the contacts by not making payment, that payment was simply following the orders of the Iranian government.
This argument you just said, that McKesson cut off the contacts, did you make that argument in the brief? I don't remember it.
Yes.
Okay.
As to the district court's challenge findings and conclusions, a court cannot decide whether there was a come-to-the-company requirement under Iranian law or a futility defense under that law without knowing what that law is. This is particularly true with respect to the authenticity of the October 16, 1981 minutes. The district court didn't, which applied the come-to-the-company requirement to McKesson. The district court thought that the minutes were a forgery because there were two other examples of the minutes that didn't have the come to the company language in it. But the articles of association talk about extracts of minutes, and those extracts are created for publication into the official gazette. We offered a witness on this at trial, Dr. Sanai. He rejected Dr. Sanai's testimony on the grounds that he was an expert witness and this was a fact trial, and then he didn't have a legal trial. So we say that was clearly erroneous. I'm almost out of time. I'll keep the rest for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Mark Bravin for the plaintiffs, McKesson Corporation and its affiliates. We were last before this court 7 years ago, and at that time, Iran's counsel went on at great length about how it had been precluded from proving its case because the decisions of the district court on liability were decided on summary judgment, and it was entitled to a trial. Well, Iran got its wish. After years of discovery and motions practice, and after Judge Leon sat through a three-week trial, hearing from Iran's witnesses admit on the stand that they had lied and that the premise for the trial was false. Judge Leon confirmed every one of Judge Flannery's findings as being true and correct. So Iran got its trial, and it proved absolutely nothing of what it told this court it would prove.
But of course, the question before us here is whether there is a cause of action in this in the district court under the Treaty of Amity, right?
Well,
and that's
yes,
an open question.
It is one of the questions before the court, okay. And the question was answered initially by Judge Flannery. It was answered by this court in McKesson 3.
We vacated that.
It was vacated, but with the limited purpose of asking the district court to determine whether the U.S. government's views
We vacated the whole decision.
It was
vacated the whole discussion of the Treaty of Amity.
There was nothing in this court's remand order that indicated it was giving up on its own views. It was asking the district court to find out through its consideration of the U.S. government's reviews.
Let's assume we don't agree with you about that, okay?
Okay.
Just assume for purposes of argument that the Treaty of Amity issue is an open question. Can you explain to me why your argument has any validity in view of the Supreme Court's decision in Medellin?
Medellin.
There's two parts of Medellin I want to ask you about. The statement that the background presumption is that international agreements, even those directly benefiting private persons, generally do not create private rights or provide a private right of action in district courts, and its statement that the U.S. interpretation of a treaty is entitled to great deference.
First, I'll answer the question about Medellin's treatment of treaties. Medellin admitted that there are self-executing treaties that provide a cause of action. This case is one of those rare cases where the treaty expressly provides a cause of action. There is no dispute between the governments and McKesson.
But the question is, where is that cause of action to be litigated? Here or in Iran?
Oh, there's no question, Your Honor, that it's to be litigated here. This court has held that. There's no question. This court has held that jurisdiction over McKesson's claims is properly found under the FSIA in this court. And so all that remains is, does the treaty provide a right and a remedy that allows McKesson to recover for the value of its property? Medellin said nothing about what language in a treaty is necessary in order to create a cause of action. It simply said, if the treaty does not have the language of a cause of action, the fact that it's self-executing isn't going to be enough. We have that treaty. There's no dispute. The treaty provides the right not to have property expropriated for a discriminatory purpose, and it has the remedy of compensation spelled out in sufficient detail that the district court was able to find for McKesson for a specific sum of money.
And where is the language that says that remedy may be pursued in district courts of the United States?
It's not in the treaty, and there's nothing in Medellin and nothing in the briefs of either Iran or the United States that provides any support for the assertion that the treaty by itself must say in a United States court. Iran admits that the treaty is a sufficient cause of action to be asserted by McKesson in a court. Its quibble is whether it should be in an Iranian court or the U.S. court. But that's a jurisdictional question, and it's already been addressed. It wasn't subject to remand. It wasn't vacated by this court. It remains the law of this case. Nothing in Medellin changes that. And so with a self-executing treaty that all sides agree has the right and remedy language that we're asking for relief from and on which the district court based its judgment, this is not the hard question of what happens when there's a presumption. We've met the presumption. What happens when there's not language in the treaty? We have that language.
Can you say which language in the treaty says that if property is expropriated without just compensation, somebody can recover damages or recover the amount of the, forgetting about which court, that says that it can be recovered in a court?
Well, the treaty does not say in a court. That issue has been decided time and again by this court and by the Supreme Court when focusing on what is a cause of action. A cause of action, whether it's under a treaty or under a statute, is the right to recover a remedy. That's all that's required. When the United States, in its Supreme Court brief in this case, cited to one of the leading experts in the issue of individual rights under a treaty, Professor Vasquez of Georgetown Law School, it misconstrued the fundamental principle that a right and a remedy are all that's necessary. The treaty does not require the something more of a reference to going to court or specifying which court. The United States hasn't cited any authority for its view that you need something more. Iran hasn't supported that view. And in a case like this, where the two governments are at odds as to whether there is even a cause of action under the treaty, this court doesn't need to defer. The Supreme Court has said time and again, if the parties to the treaty can't agree on what it means, no deference is due. And when the issue before the court is whether the treaty provides a cause of action, no deference is due. That's not one of the questions that the Supreme Court has reserved for the executive. It's an issue for the court. And the question is, are there enough indicia of a cause of action in this case under the treaty? And we submit that there is. Now, turning to the customary international law issue.
Yeah, if I could put it in a less confusing way than I put to the opposing counsel. So their position is, at least less confusing to me, if their position is that if there were no cause of action under the treaty, and I'll ask you to assume that, that that would affect the act of state doctrine's application to the customary international law question.
There is absolutely no basis for that position that Mr. Corcoran answered in the affirmative. The treaty provides a rule, a substantive rule. And as Your Honor mentioned, the fact that it provides a substantive rule is separate and apart from whether it provides a cause of action. In this case, the rule is sufficient to provide that cause of action. But if the court disagrees, it nevertheless must recognize that the right and remedy are there. And the Supreme Court and this court and other courts that have focused on the issue have found that where a treaty provides a substantive rule to decide the claims, there is no act of state defense. That was found in the Sixth Circuit decision in Kalamazoo Spice. It's consistent with Sabatino. It's consistent with all of the cases that have focused on this issue of whether a treaty can be brought to bear on the question of a controlling legal standard. Now, earlier we heard that somehow the government and maybe Iran were hoodwinked and not given an opportunity to argue the customary international law issue. That is wrong. As Your Honor pointed out, Judge Garland, it was decided after full briefing by Judge Flannery that there was a customary international law right of action separate and independent from the treaty. When the issue came before this court, we got no guidance. The court said we agree in most respects and proceeded to point out the few respects in which it disagreed. Customary international law was not one of them. It left some doubt as to what the court's intentions were. Iran moved for reconsideration and recall of the mandate and asked this court to either decide the customary international law expressly or instruct the district court to reconsider it. This court decided not to do that. It only remanded the treaty issue for reconsideration. On remand to the district court, Iran brought up the issue of customary international law again in a motion for reconsideration and to dismiss. And on June 19, 2003, we filed a memorandum of law to Judge Leon explaining why we thought the customary international law ruling of Judge Flannery was the law of the case. It was not part of the remand instruction from this court, and it should not be reconsidered. And after giving the matter some thought, Judge Leon issued a minute order denying Iran's motion to reconsider. No reasons were given, so we don't know exactly what was on his mind, whether he had read Iran's brief and concluded that there was nothing in there that was new, that hadn't been raised with Judge Flannery, or whether this court's mandate simply didn't allow him to revisit the question.
Was there pending some indication from the government that it was going to file something?
The government filed something a bit later in the case, not right off the bat in June of 2003. We didn't know yet. And when the United States filed its brief, it only dealt with the treaty issue. It didn't, it wasn't stopped from raising the CIA, the customary international law issue then, nor in its brief to this court. The government just has chosen to take no position. And I think it's quite important to focus on the few elements of Judge Flannery's decision that warrant an express affirmance by this court on the customary international law cause of action. First, the Supreme Court has addressed this question under customary international law in First National City Bank versus Banco para el Comercio Exterior de Cuba. And in that case and in subsequent Court of Appeals decisions in the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuit that are cited in our brief, the courts have found that there is a clear accepted substantive rule of international law that when a foreign government expropriates property without paying compensation, that gives right to a cause of action for the harmed party. Several acts of Congress have addressed this. We heard from some of the questions before about the Hickenlooper Amendment. The Hickenlooper Amendment's first enactment, that's 28 U.S.C. 2370E1, it defined what was a taking in violation of international law, and it dealt with the president's cutting off of funds to countries that violate that international law principle. But the second Hickenlooper Amendment went directly to the question of adjudication of rights of the expropriated investor under international law. And in that statute, Congress said the active state doctrine will not be available and shall not be applied to prevent the adjudication of the claim of a taking under customary international law. The Restatement of Foreign Relations Law, Section 712, expressly provides for this type of cause of action under customary international law. And the United States executive for 25 or 30 years has been out front in espousing the rights of U.S. investors to be protected under international law from precisely the kinds of things that happened to McKesson in this case. So all of the forces line up. There's no dispute among the political branches and the courts on this question. It's not a difficult one. It's an unusual one, but it's not a difficult one. Now, we did not hear much from Mr. Corcoran about his complaints about the trial, but what we did hear had a number of misstatements, and I'd like to just briefly go over them. And in so doing, I think I have to intersperse a few comments about the about what we heard from counsel for the United States. First, Mr. Byron said that the U.S. government has never taken another position from the one that it took in its brief to the Supreme Court and then again before this court against the treaty cause of action. That is false. We included in our briefs two very clear statements by the U.S. government, not by our law firm, on this issue. First, to the Iran Claims Tribunal, where the United States said very clearly that there's nothing in the Treaty of Amity that prevents McKesson from litigating this claim in this court. And secondly, in a brief to the district court in 1996, where the United States again expressed to the court its view that there was no reason why the court could not reach McKesson's cause of action. On the issue of Iranian law, both parties were in agreement, and the United States had a few words to say about the Iranian law cause of action, that the district court should take it up. It was briefed to a certain extent before Judge Flannery, but Judge Leon decided he didn't need to reach it. Iranian law being complicated in a foreign language, and after hearing Iran's witnesses for 3 weeks make a jumble of what they had claimed was going on in Iran, he elected not to reach the question. We don't think it would be appropriate for this court to remand for consideration of the Iranian law cause of action, even though we're convinced that we would prevail on that cause of action. As Iran has admitted, the treaty is part of Iranian law, and it allows for a cause of action of this kind, and there's nothing under substantive Iranian law, we think, that would make a difference. But to send this case back now, after 26 years of litigation, to reach a question of why, whether McKesson can prevail in a U.S. court under Iranian law, when it's clear that McKesson ought to prevail and has prevailed under the law of this land as expressed in the Treaty of Amity and under customary international law, doesn't make any sense. There's really no reason to put that burden back on the district court. This court did ask the district court to take another close look at the treaty, and Judge Leanne looked at every one of these arguments. There were several rounds of briefing on the treaty. There were two hearings. He gave it very close attention. Nothing in Medellin, which came out after his decision, has anything else to say on the issues that underlied his decision. And so for all of these reasons, the treaty decision was properly decided, the customary international law was properly decided, and nothing that Mr. Corcoran has said today or in his brief detracts at all from the factual underpinnings of the court's decision on the merits. In answer to a question, Mr. Corcoran said that there were some new facts that came out at trial that somehow allowed him to raise for the fourth or fifth time an FSIA defense. That is wrong. The FSIA defense was litigated in McKesson 1, McKesson 2, and McKesson 3, and there was nothing left to decide. The law of for the attraction and protection of foreign investment was part of this case from the beginning. There was nothing that Mr. Corcoran said about that law that was the subject of testimony that resulted in a finding by Judge Leon. It is counsel's testimony. It is not evidence in this case, and it's certainly not a ground for this court to revisit a settled question. Judge Leon's comments about capital flight have nothing to do with this case. Iran cites Weltover as authority for reopening the issue. It's wrong. Weltover did not say that any reference to capital flight as an excuse for cutting off commercial obligations is grounds for dismissing a case on sovereign immunity grounds. Rather, it said if there is a commercial nature to the conduct of the state, that is all it takes. And there's no doubt in this case that Pak Dairy was acting in a commercial capacity when it cut off trade with Iran's trading partner in the United States, when it cut off dividends, when it cut off the flow of goods and capital. That was the finding of the district court twice. That was the finding of this court in McKesson 3. Judge Leon's comment about capital flight was an offhand remark. It was about his sense that this trial, which had been ordered by this court to focus on whether the real reason for non-payment of dividends was a come-to-the-company requirement, was false. There were other reasons. And the record of the trial will show that Iran's key witness, Mr. Dadiar, gave plenty of reasons. The principal one was that Pak Dairy didn't have the money. Cash flow, he called it. He had other reasons. Capital flight was not one of them. To be honest, we don't know where that comment came from in the opinion. It's there, but it doesn't really have any significance. The decision was fully addressed by Judge Flannery, and there was nothing new in the trial. And there's nothing in the decision of Judge Leon that would support any different result. There are no further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Does counsel have any time left? You can take 2 minutes.
Your Honor, one of the reasons that you defer to the position of the treaty parties in deciding what a treaty means is, of course, they negotiated it and they have a better understanding than anyone else what was intended. So I think that when it comes to what does a treaty mean, what do the treaty parties intend, deference should be given to the interpretation of the treaty parties. And it's quite clear that the treaty parties here are in agreement that there's no cause of action in this case in a U.S. court. Furthermore, I think the treaty parties, I mean, at least Iran, I think we've shown that the intention at the time was to create an exclusive remedy ending up in the International Court of Justice. It's hard to see what else they had in mind. And although the United States government doesn't take that position today, it seems to have taken that position in the past. As to the second, jurisdiction issue, Iran's position at the trial was that the reason that the dividends were not paid, we didn't say it was a come-to-the-company requirement. We said until September 29th, 1981, it was a come-to-the-company requirement. And before that time, they didn't pay because they couldn't. It was against the law.
Can I just back you up? On the question about the International Court of Justice, you're referring to Article 21?
21.2.
That just says any dispute between the high contracting parties as to the interpretation or application of the treaty.
Yes. Well, this is an application of the treaty.
This isn't a dispute between the parties. It's between a plaintiff and one of the parties.
Yes, but that was what the treaty parties were talking about. They were creating...
They didn't say that.
They didn't have to say it. Because that the legal system, the background
but
legal
the text,
system...
Here the text doesn't matter.
No, the text does matter, but if you look at the negotiating history of the treaty is clearly intended to apply to claims such as this. Even though the high contracting party has to adopt McKesson's claim, I grant you that, but that's what the treaty party is intended.
I understand.
Okay. Finally, Iran did not get its wish at this trial. It didn't get to try the entire issue of liability. It's quite clear that there is an expropriation in this case. Pactiv has never taken these shares. They were never able to prove to the tribunal they couldn't sell their shares. We represented during the trial that the shares were worth $5 million, and they could sell their shares, and we'd help them sell their shares. And if they came to the company, we'd give them their dividends.
Well, now, this is a finding against you by the district court. This would require us to say this is a clear error on this point.
No,
this is your strongest argument. The district court found that there wasn't a come-to-the-company requirement.
Well, the district court, but there's a prior issue. That is the interpretation of the remand order. If there's no expropriation, it doesn't make any difference whether there's a come-to-the-company requirement. But I think, Your Honor, if he'd had a legal trial and heard the Iranian experts, they would all say that the come-to-the-company requirement is the presumptive requirement in Iran. He refused to hear the evidence. Your Honor, the evidence about cutoff, where I talked about cutoff of contacts in the brief, that's page 47. If there are no further
questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
It's submitted.